Built Not Born, episode 139. Hey everyone, it's Joe Ciccarone. Thanks so much for tuning in. Today's guest is Angelo Cataldi. Angelo Cataldi is the longtime dominant force in Philadelphia sports talk radio. Angelo was the host of the WIP Morning Show for 33 years. Angelo joins us today to discuss his new book, Loud, How a Shy Nerd Came to Philadelphia and Turned Up the Volume in the Most Passionate Sports City in America. Angelo and I have a far-ranging discussion on all things Philly sports. We talk Eagles, Flyers, Sixers, Buddy Ryan, the Super Bowl wins, Super Bowl losses, 93 Phillies, what it was like to be at Vets Stadium during that awful loss to Tampa Bay in the NFC Championship game back in the day. We talk Allen Iverson, Jason Kelce. Angelo tells so many great stories, including the craziness of the Wing Bowl. Was so excited to get Angelo on the show. He has been the backdrop to morning drives for 30 years in Philadelphia. He shares so many amazing stories from his book. We discuss the challenges of hosting a morning radio show that's made him get to the office at 3 a.m., some nights not sleeping at all, and what effect that had on his mental health. Angelo is so forthcoming about his struggles with depression and just how hard it was to stay on top for 30 years and to keep everything fresh and the grind that takes to stay at the top of your game for that long. It was such an honor to have Angelo on the show. It's a fun episode. I hope you enjoy. If you like what you hear, hit that follow button, or better yet, please share this episode with a friend. We got a bunch of cool interviews like this one to come. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Joe Ciccarone. This is Built Not Born. Get ready for the one and only Angelo Cataldi. And remember, life is built, not born.
How you doing, Joe?
Hey, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining. So excited to speak.
Happy to do it.
Awesome. Awesome. First off, love your book. It brought me through 30 years of listening to you on the radio, and man, you knocked that out of the park.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. It was fun to do. I'm really happy with the reaction it's gotten. It's gotten a really good reaction.
I'd love to go over some stuff from the book. Love to cover some creativity ideas, how you wrote the book, how you decided to do it. You were always one of the best interviewers. Like, I always thought you and Howard Stern were two of the best interviewers I've heard. And this is what makes a good interview for you. Like, I've never left an interview with you when you interviewed someone on the radio. I never left there like, wow, they didn't ask them this or they didn't ask them that. You always asked them what we were thinking, which was just so awesome. Anyway, we'll get going. And the 60 minutes still work for you?
Oh, sure. Whatever you need, Joe.
Oh, we're going to knock this out of the park. All right, we'll get going. Angelo Cataldi, welcome to the show.
Joe, it's a pleasure to be here with you. I really appreciate the invitation.
Angelo, it is such an honor to have you on. Angelo, for our listeners who may not be familiar with you and your work, who are you and what do you do?
Well, I am currently now a retired 73-year-old person, but prior to that, I was a journalist for about 20 years. I worked at my hometown paper, the Providence Journal. I went to Columbia University Graduate School for Journalism. Then I went to the Inquirer, where I covered the Flyers and the Eagles. And then I ended up, for the final 33 years, in radio. And I had a morning radio show on WIP, one of the very first sports shows. And it was an honor and a pleasure to be able to talk to the great Philadelphia sports fans for all that time.
I would love to get into your book, Loud. It was like the fastest 8 hours I've done on Audible. I'd also like to get into how someone spent 33 years in Philadelphia, who grew up in Rhode Island as a Yankee fan, wound up owning the Philadelphia radio market for 3 decades. How is that even possible? That is crazy. Let's start here. So, Angelo, you're at the Columbia School of Journalism. Take us from there. How do you wind up in Philadelphia? Well,
that was the one that really set my path. I knew I wanted to be a writer when I was in high school. And I went to school for that. But my undergraduate was at the University of Rhode Island, which was a really very challenging. And when I got into Columbia, which was a real long shot, the very first day I went there, Isser, who had run the Louisville Courier Journal, a man named Norman Isaacs. And I sat down, and the first thing I said to the guy was, "Mr. Isaacs, my dream is to write sports for my life." And he was not at all happy with that, because Columbia had higher aspirations than sports writing. They wanted you to be a syndicated columnist or foreign correspondent, or to run a paper, a managing editor of a newspaper. And so he made me make him two promises. One was that I wouldn't tell anybody that was my plan, because he said they won't take you seriously at Columbia if you want to write sports. And the second thing is, he said, and this was the one that really set a focus for my whole career, he said, "If you're really going to do sports, do it right. Don't do it the way they do it. All this hero worship, all this ass kissing that goes on in sports writing. Cover them the way you would the White House, or cover them the way you would City Hall." And I'll tell you, Joe, that was the best lesson I got in my career, because I did that. It allowed me a very good, very successful career in journalism, asking hard questions, making tons of enemies along the way, because nobody was doing that in sports. And then taking that lesson of holding people accountable and bringing it to my radio show, where if a player screwed up, you could rest assured the next day I was going to rip them good and strong and hard and honestly, with my honest feelings toward them. And that's what I'm proudest of, that I actually followed the template that professor taught me almost 50 years ago.
And not to jump ahead, but there was a point where I think you interviewed President Obama, and you know, he was like giving his like college hoops picks, right? Like he was just there to give us, I think Kentucky's going to win March Madness. Right. And you came at him like it was like he was on Meet the Press. And then he said something about his grandmom, and then like it was like a national controversy for a couple days.
Here's the thing, all right? That wouldn't have happened if I hadn't gone to Columbia, because Columbia did train me how to do that kind of an interview. So I, you know, the one thing I always did is I always really prepared for the interviews I was doing. That was, even in my radio career, that was the one element of journalism I kept doing, because I had a lot of interviews every day and I prepped hard for them. And I prepped for an interview as if I was a political reporter and I was asking him political stuff. He was not prepared to deal with that. He wanted to tell me that Duke was going to win the national championship. And I got off the air and I thought I had knocked it out of the park. And his people called us afterwards and went, "You know, that wasn't why we booked Obama. That isn't, we didn't assume that was your audience at all. We thought your audience was going to want to hear the presidential candidate." It was 2008. So here's the great kicker to the story, though. So we got to book him the following week again, in which all we did was talk basketball. So I got to interview Obama twice, because I screwed the first one up so badly. And you're right, he said a couple of things that stirred up the the political pot for a day or two, but blew over. And he was a real gentleman and a very nice man.
I mentioned before we hit record, the two people that when they interviewed someone, I'm like, that is what I wanted them to ask. It's Howard Stern and you. You're the two that, like, when the guest gets off, there's not like, "Oh, I wish they asked them this," or "I wish they asked them that." What principles make a good interview? How do you set that up?
First of all, that you can't give me a higher compliment than that. Thank you. Because when I did an interview, it wasn't my agenda. It was the listening audience's agenda. So I would always sit down before we got a player on, or whoever it was. The coach came on after every game. And I would say, "What do these people want to know?" I try to picture myself at the corner stool of a bar right in the city of Philadelphia and go, what are they talking about? You know, was there a dumb decision by the coach? Was there something that people weren't sure of why it happened? The one thing I have to do is make sure I get that to that question. But you don't lead with it. You lead with that question and they recoil and they shut down. So what you do is you develop in the first few minutes a camaraderie, a level of comfort that allows you to ask tougher questions in a non-combative way. And I found that that way, it's once in a while I had to get combative because the other guy was lying and you had to call him on that. Mm-hmm. That happened to me with Gabe Kapler one time. He just lied. And I said, that's not acceptable. We know that didn't happen, et cetera. But normally, if you're respectful, you will get the answers to those questions. Now, not always. Andy Reid wouldn't do it. Andy Reid never respected the audience enough to give an honest answer to a question. He only cared about placating the people in his locker room. But if you had a guy who was honest, like Doug Peterson, the guy that won us a championship in Philadelphia, you would get the answer you were hoping to get. A lot of times you would get an answer better than you could have assumed, but you had to ask the question. When you were done, when I was done, I never had less than like 25 questions, even though I knew I wouldn't use half of them. Mm-hmm. First few was set to really kind of develop that camaraderie. And then you got to the real gist of the answers that you were seeking. And it was a strategy I learned in journalism school. And it is a strategy to serve me well my whole career.
That reminds me a little bit of Tim Russert, the longtime host of Meet the Press. It's so good, right? He would say like Meet the Press was an hour and he would prepare like it was a 3-hour interview.
Right. Well, here's the thing. You mentioned Stern too. Stern.
No, oh yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant interview. The thing that made them great was their fearlessness. Mm-hmm. Stern especially would not fear for a moment, would not fear for a moment probing their sex lives. Or he was doing the same thing I was doing in a different way. He was going, my audience, we talk a lot of sex on Howard Stern Show. I'm going to make sure, you know, if I got Pam Anderson on, I'm going to ask her about Tommy Lee and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And he did it. That's just what you're supposed to do as an interviewer. Too often, you'll hear an interview and you'll realize that the interviewer is just trying to ingratiate themselves to the subject.
Sure.
They're never going to get a good interview. So hopefully the people that are doing that interviewing will understand how to set it up. And that is to see who the audience is and then ask the questions they want to ask. That's the key to it.
Perfect. I appreciate that. How about this? One thing I found so fascinating. How does losing the Pulitzer Prize and Buddy Ryan, two things don't usually go in the same sentence. How does Buddy Ryan and losing a Pulitzer Prize bring you into radio?
All right. So in 1980, so it's 85, I covered the first year that Buddy Ryan was coach of the Eagles. And what he basically did was just pile lie on top of lie on top of lie. They were going to, he announced that at training camp, they were going to win all 8 division games, you know, and that kind of stuff. Here's the funny part about it, though. I at the midway point in that season where it was clear that all the promises he had made were not going to pan out, I took a week off from the beat of covering the Eagles to hold him accountable for all of that stuff. And it was strong, potent journalism. And in retrospect, it was misguided because he knew he wasn't telling it. He was just firing the fan base up. Mm-hmm. And I cut that part of it. Eluded me. So I wrote this stuff and my paper sent it in as a submission for the Pulitzer. And it was a finalist for that honor because it was so different. Most people didn't cover sports that way. Mm-hmm. But two things because of it. One is I was wrong. Buddy accomplished a lot by activating the fan base the way he did. The Eagles are more popular today in Philadelphia because Buddy Ryan was their coach for 5 years. And the second thing is, if I had won that, I couldn't have gone into radio.
Yeah.
You win that award, you now you have this legacy to uphold for the next 30 years. And none of it would have worked out. The best thing, one of the best things that ever happened to me in my career is that I didn't win. But at the time, it was like, well, I could have been a Pulitzer Prize winner. Well, you didn't deserve it anyway. It was dumb. What you did really wasn't, history has proven it really wasn't this interrogation that was required. It was to look beyond why you were saying the things we were, to understand, you know, the impact of them. But back then, I was a journalist to the nth degree. And I'm glad it worked out the way it did, because I got to stop being a journalist because I didn't win that award.
And you'd probably have to write a lot more boring books than you did now. You know what I mean? Your books would probably be more serious and boring. But getting back to Buddy Ryan real quick, I am an Eagle fan because of Buddy Ryan. I was about 13 in like 85. And the Eagles were always something my dad watched until I was about 12, 13. And Buddy Ryan came from the Bears. He was like the D coordinator. And they come in and we're going to win all the games. And I think it was Reggie White was in his prime. And he built that defense up. There were some bad men on that defense. Jerome Brown, Seth Joyner, Wes Hopkins. And we just became fans. So like everyone my age just became Eagle fans with Buddy Ryan. And 30 years later, we're still rabid Eagle fans. And now our kids are Eagle fans. And it all started with Buddy Ryan. Is it Marion Campbell in front of him? I forget who was the...
Marion Campbell was before him.
And he was like a dud. Anyway, Buddy made me a fan. And when you said that, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm one of those guys that Buddy made the Eagles popular.
Yeah, the kick of the story, Joe, is that after I wrote this thing that was really, really nasty toward him, he wouldn't talk to me for the rest of the season. Mm-hmm. And it was really a contentious relationship, which part of me was like, well, this is the way it's supposed to be. I'm doing my job the right way. And then years later, when I had a better perspective on what he was doing in those first years, he came on my radio show a few times and we kind of bonded a little bit. And I said to him a few times, buddy, I understand it more now than I did when I was there. And you know what? This is a funny thing, Jerry. He went, you were just doing your job. Don't worry about it. Buddy, underneath that gruff exterior, was actually a nice man. He really was a nice man. He was just, as a coach, he was hellacious. He was really tough. And I watched as you were describing how you became a fan, and the joy you were describing was the potency, the viciousness of his defense, right?
Crazy.
That what he knew exactly what Philadelphia loved.
Yeah.
Vicious. And you know who else I got to? I get to know Seth Joyner in the last years I was on at the
YP.
And Seth Joyner was perfect for Buddy Ryan. He had that take no prisoners philosophy.
He's always angry. He's just angry. He wants to tackle someone every time you see him. Oh my God.
And Andre Waters and of course Reggie White and Jerome Brown. And the only problem Buddy had is he never focused enough on the other side of the ball, you know?
He might
have had a dynasty if he did the same thing on offense.
Oh my gosh. So here we are. So you lose the you're runner up for the Pulitzer Prize, which is amazing. Buddy Ryan's the coach. Then what's it like? Ed Snyder starts and Tom Brookshire starts a radio station. Okay. And then, and they need to fill some slots. Take it from there.
Well, Ed hadn't quite come on yet. It was a radio station that was struggling mightily. And WFAN had just started with the sports format and they were out and running quickly. And they went, well, if it's going to work in New York, it will definitely work in Philadelphia. It's a great sports town. Let's just convert it to sports format. And I'm telling you, in the snap of fingers, they did it. There was only one problem at the time. This was 1988. And there weren't enough experienced sports talk show hosts to fill 24 hours a day. Mm-hmm. Even FAN at that time still had Imus in the morning. So they didn't have a 24-hour calendar, but they wanted to do 24 here. They didn't have enough people. So Brookie did the only thing he could. Brookie agreed to make an investment in it and to be the morning host initially, not for a long period of time, but initially, because at that point he had his number retired as a great Eagle player. And then he had 25 years at CBS as a top analyst. And now he's coming home to do this thing. And basically, they didn't have people. So Bookie said, well, who knows sports? Well, the writers do. Let's try the writers. And he hit us at just the time at the Inquirer, where we hated our boss with a passion. Our boss was just, I don't want to, to this day, all these years later, I'm still bitter at having to work with that guy. He just, he edited copy with a hacksaw. He was not a good writer, but he thought he was. It was awful. So we had all these malcontents. Me first, then Mike Missinelli, Glenn Macnow was in on that, Al Morgani was in. We all moved over. Wow. But it, for a period of time, we did both jobs.
Okay.
We did part-time at the radio station and full-time at the newspaper. But then the newspaper kind of got upset because we were becoming popular, not for writing, but for talking. And they started to make it harder for us to do it. So when the WIP came to me in 1990, they offered me $20,000 more than I was making at the newspaper. And I went, you know, $20,000. And then I took a 20-year journalism career and I flushed it. Went right, for 20 grand, Joe, I just sold out. And it was like, wow, am I really doing this? But in the back of my mind the whole time, it was, well, I'll do this for a year or two and then I'll go back.
Mm-hmm.
But newspapers were on the decline. Sports mm-hmm. radio was on the incline.
Yep.
And I never had to do that. Instead, I did 33 straight years.
And then when you started, and this is bringing me back to almost high school. So I remember Brookie was kind of like the lead. You were kind of like the secondary person there, yeah. right? There's Brookie's right. show. And yep. then I remember Pat Croce came after you, maybe? Was Pat Croce yes. the show after you or something?
For a while, Pat Croce did a fitness show after hours.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep. And then, right. When you started, like you were making like $50, $75 like an hour.
$75 an hour. Yes.
Jesus.
And part-time. Now, when I got there, they gave me the incredible amount of $75,000, where I was only making $55 at the newspaper. But now I'm getting up at 3:30 in the morning, and it's yeah. And I thought, I'm getting more money. I don't have to work as hard, which I learned from Brookie very quickly was not true. You had to work harder because those 4 hours were you. They weren't you and editors. It was you.
You
better have something.
And there was a point, like fast forward a little bit, there was a point where, wasn't there before Brookie retired, he thought you weren't picking it up fast enough and kind of gave you some, kind of gave it to you?
First year around Thanksgiving, it was almost a full year we were together. At the end of the show, he snapped. I guess I didn't give him what he wanted that day. And he was, I'm really tired of carrying your sorry ass. He said it to me. And it was the greatest wake-up call I got in my career because it wasn't that I didn't have a good work ethic. I've always had that. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know that he planned to leave. His original plan, the way he explained it to me later, was he wanted to do 1 year and get out. He didn't want to. He was a very rich man, very popular guy. He could do whatever he wanted. Was he getting up so early and doing his job for? And I hadn't emerged. So he said to me, step it up. In his own way, and I did. That was the last day I took a back seat. From that point on, that next 13 months, I worked harder, forced my way in more. He backed off a little more. Mm-hmm. And by that time, the following year, he didn't even tell anyone, Joe. He came on the year live. And he went, I just want everybody to know at the end of the year, I'm leaving.
Oh, he didn't tell you.
Didn't tell anyone. Well, I guess he told his wife. He didn't tell anyone else. We all found out on the air. We're wow. Oh my God, that's unbelievable. And I'm thinking, well, that's not, now I'm cooked. without the Brookshire name, what am I going to do? But he had taught me enough, like sink or swim. And he had given me enough information to be able to figure it out. And if he had done it after the first year, I probably wouldn't have been able to make it. But he groomed me, and he groomed me brilliantly. And by the time he left, I had enough to keep it going until I figured the rest of it out.
And then people today don't know like the influence Brookshire had. Like he was the top guy on CBS football for a long time.
Yeah.
Like his show, you write in the book, like when his show that people would call in, like Magic Johnson would call in. It was almost like a president was retiring. The top people in sports were calling in.
The best story I got about that is, so we're still feeling our way. And he lands the big whale. He gets Bobby Knight. Bobby Knight does no interviews. And now he's landing Bobby Knight. And it was, I'm not sure the exact timing, but people were still talking about the time he threw the chair. Mm-hmm. So he comes on the air and Brookie is there. Hey, my buddy. And then two pals talking away. And they go on for about 10 minutes. And then I'm going, well, I guess I'm trying to make sure I'm contributing something to the show at that point. So I stop and I go, hi, Bobby, Angelo Cataldi here. And I ask him a real serious journalistic question. I don't know if it was around the chair. I can't remember, but it was a question that broke the nice cadence that they had. And there's like this long pause, right? And then the next thing you hear is Bobby Knight saying to Brookie, hey, Brookie, who the hell is that? And Brookie had this great laugh and he said, oh, that's my co-host, Angelo Cataldi. Angelo, say hi to Bobby Knight. Joe, I don't even remember if he answered my question. I know I never said another thing in the rest of that interview, but there was never a point then or with all the other famous people that came out when Brookie was there that he ever said I couldn't talk or I couldn't ask my question or be involved in it, which kind of tells you that he was trying to groom me for the job, for the main job. And he was great that way. And the other thing about him that people would never believe, because he was so successful as a football player and as a broadcaster, he was there 4 o'clock every morning. The show started at 6. Tom Brooks' show was in that office at 4 o'clock every morning, planning the show, planning the interviews, talking to me and to the producer, and making sure he knew what he was doing for those hours that we were on together. And that was the model I used. I went, wow, if he's getting there at 4 and he's Tom Brookshire, I better get there at 3:30. And that's when I got there. When I was on my own, I did it at 3:30 because I figured, well, if he needs 2 hours, I need 2.5. Because Tom Brookshire is far more adept at this than I am. But over time, I figured it out.
Yeah. There was Glenn Macnow. There was Al Morgani.
Like myself.
Yeah. What do you think he saw in you to have you be the one that kind of take the mantle?
That's a great, I wish I knew. We did the part-time show. Al Morganti was the one that initiated the first interview that got us the part-time show. We used to go from 9 to 10. It was called the Morning Sports Pig. Somewhere in there, he and the guy that was running the station, Tom Bigby, saw me as, I guess it was because I was provocative. And that was by nature. It wasn't that I was doing it for the radio. I tended to be highly critical and could do it in a, really show emotion. Mm-hmm. Al was funnier than me, but was not as emotional. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think they came to me first. And they went, I think this guy can carry a show. They'll lose a game and he'll come on and he'll point fingers and he'll yell and scream. And the fans will get excited because they probably would think of the same thing. And then they'll call in and there'll be a show, that kind of thing. I don't know though, because, I don't really sound that much like a broadcaster. And I also think Brookie had such a long career. More than knowing I would be able to do it, he hoped I would be able to do it. that's when I think it was time to go, well, we don't have any other options here. Let's try this one.
At what point did you become a radio person? Like, you were a journalist. Do you remember the moment where the interview or the day you showed up that you're like, you know what? I belong here. This is my show and I'm in this is my career.
It's a great, wow. One moment. And it wasn't for a few years because I was still hedging my bets. Mm-hmm. Until 93-94. I guess we had a bumpy ride with the Macho Row Phillies of 93. So mm-hmm. I wasn't feeling it then for sure. Sometime between the end of that 1993 Philly season and 1995, I decided that this was going to work out. We were doing a lot of stunts on the air. We were, maybe it was this stunt we did where we were at Veterans Stadium. And I had told Tony Bruno had joined us, and he was a great fit for what we were doing because he really knew, like, he really knew broadcasting. And I told Tony that my arm was so great that I could throw the ball from the 700 level of Veterans Stadium, the very top of the stadium, and get the ball past second base. And he laughed at me, and he said, well, that's stupid, right? That you can't do that. And a regular Phillies outfielder could do it from the 700 level. It's the very top of the stadium. Well, I had talked to people who gave me a suggestion of how that might work if I aimed it correctly. So we went out there for opening day, and I got the ball. And this got a lot of attention for us, too. And I went up to the 700 level, and I uncorked the hardest throw I could possibly make. It barely cleared the over. It just got over. It just made it. It bounced right near the warning track in left field. And then it did what these guys told me. If it had enough momentum and it hit that artificial turf, it would roll forever. So Tony's standing near second base, and he's watching the ball as it comes in, and it's just rolling and rolling and rolling, and it just keeps going and going and going. It goes right by second base. He screams out, oh, my God, he did it. He did it. And it kept rolling, Joe. Went all the way into the dugout. And then some girl who's standing there, she was just sitting with us. She was not even 20, maybe 18 or 19. There was another ball there. And she saw it, and without prompting by anyone, she just got it, threw it. It was a little lower than me, but she threw it over the overhand. And it did the same thing. And then Tony went, wait a minute. That doesn't mean anything. But people, it was like, it was one of the great moments in that people started to see us as more than just sports talk. It was personality. You know, we became, people knew who we were. And then we started to talk more personally on the air about things that frustrated us. We would incorporate things in our lives that were going haywire. And as people got to know us more, it really locked us in. And it gave us a loyal audience that hung in through the highs and lows of sports seasons.
Yeah, you became people. Like, you're following your lives, or like medical procedures you were doing, or whatever's going on in your lives. And it was almost like a continuation. It was like an arc where, like, if you listened Monday and didn't hear listen Tuesday, you missed something, right? Like it would add on, right?
Soap opera. We did a colonoscopy on there. We just did all the stuff that we thought would get people to listen. It always was, there had to be like a drama, you know, the best one. I mean, I'm not going to tell you everything we did was totally legit. There was a theatrical level to it. When we started to incorporate these stunts into what was going on in sports, we had Herschel Walker was a free agent. And we thought it would be great if the Eagles signed him. And we started a campaign for him. And we decided to hunt for Herschel. And we got people. And we said, we want everybody out in the streets of Philadelphia at exactly 8 o'clock at a set time. We'll do a countdown. We want you to honk your horn if you want the Eagles to sign Herschel Walker. And we invited him over to the sports complex. And we thought we might get 100, 200 cars. And it would really sound great. But only like a dozen showed up. And so they were doing a little, they were going on in a circle near the sports complex. And Al was out there doing it. And Al was saying just before we started, guys, this isn't going to sound very good. There's not that many people out here. And I didn't even know what to do at that point. We're still learning the medium. So we count down 3, 2, 1. And it's kind of a nothing much. And then it starts to build. And it's getting louder and louder. And we're looking at each other going, oh, my God, how is this happening? It's incredible. And it ended up being like a shrill, loud. And it was like impressive. We went, Herschel Walker, I hope you're listening out there. Philadelphia loves you and we want you. Please sign. And then we went to break. And I said, well, why did Al say there's only a dozen people? It sounded amazing. And my producer, Joe Ector, said, Yeah, it sounded amazing. I added all the sound effects. The most of those horns were fake.
Joe Wechter for the win.
Joe,
oh my God.
Joe, 3 weeks later, he signed and he came on our show to show you what a phony I guess I was then. I played the tape for him. I went, Herschel, I didn't tell him it was fake. I went, Herschel, I want you to know how happy this city is. 3 weeks ago, we did this campaign for you. And listen to what happened when we cued the fans. And he listens to it and he goes, oh my gosh. He said, I can't believe I'm getting like goosebumps thinking about this. Oh, that's yeah. Awesome. I was too until I found it was.
That is great. Thanks for sharing that.
That's what we did, Joe. We did all that stuff to get attention. We were just trying to get attention because we were the new kids on the block and people had to get to know us if they were going to listen.
Yeah. And then with that, so all of a sudden, so then it's your show and then there's Al, then at one point there's Chris Gamble, Tony Bruno is a big influence, right? And you get there. How much pressure is it each day to come up with content? So like what time are you waking up for when it's your show, it's the morning show. What time does the alarm go off?
Well, the pressure that you're in a period where this is exactly what it became for me, because when I realized that this was my career now and that I had to climb this 4-hour mountain every day with the help of great co-hosts, great people around me, great producer, I started to feel the pressure real bad. And then the numbers would come in and they'd be good. They were better. We were moving up. But then the pressure got bigger. You know, oh my God, this is going better than we thought. You got to do better now. You got to get. So we got to like 1995, maybe middle of the year. And I just crashed and burned mentally. I hit a wall because you said, what time was I waking up? There were nights I wasn't waking up because I never went to sleep. I couldn't sleep. I was really overwhelmed by the responsibility. Once we became something, suddenly there was this responsibility to keep growing. And I just hit a period of very, very serious clinical depression. I ended up having to go off the air for 3 weeks while I got help. And I got help with medicine, Effexor. They put me on Effexor, which I have never gone off. I've stayed on it for all these years. And I got some therapy, which is not the only time I've gotten therapy and talked to people and made them understand that, yeah, this is a big job now and it's an important job, but it's not a job that's life and death. Stop looking at it with that seriousness. And over time, I got past that hurdle. I came back after 3 weeks. My doctor said, once a year, you got to take a 2-week break and get away from it, or it's going to eat you up eventually. And I did that. I would take the last 2 weeks of August every year, just before the start of the football season. And I got past it. And once I got past it, the growth curve was even better for us. We started to approach the job with knowing that it's fun and games, it's sports. I'm not talking about the government. I'm not talking about a war. I'm not talking about people risking their lives. We're talking about people playing games, and in the case of Philadelphia, usually losing the biggest games. So it kind of fit our negative approach to it too.
Yeah, and then with no sleep, like you could not work it out for a year, and you would be in great shape. But like, if you didn't exercise, you could get on with your life. You could eat like crap for 6 months and get on with your life. But if you're not sleeping, you can't work that out or eat good and not see. That crashes everything, right?
It does. It does. And it makes you feel more vulnerable. And I wasn't doing great when I was doing those shows with little or no sleep. I wasn't doing great. And it finally hit a wall where I was at an appearance. Because back then, it wasn't just the show, but we would do a lot of appearances, advertisers, and for charities and things like that. And I was at an appearance. It was in July. I know it was a hot day. And I was in the back of this big limo. They were pulling me up in a limo. And we got to the appearance. And I hadn't slept. And I was just like, and I couldn't get out of the car. And I just said to the guy, no, just get me out of here. I'm not doing it. And that's when I took the time off, because I realized then that this wasn't going to get better if I didn't get help. But it was, you know, you're right. The lack of sleep in that kind of job where you got to be quick, fat, sharp. You got to have the sleep. That was the thing.
And you might want to go to bed at whatever time, but like you have all this to prep, all these ideas bouncing in your head. You have the show the next day, or it might be Saturday night, and you have five shows to do that week. And just your mind plays games with you, and you got to be up and prepare. And the anxiety's got to be crazy. Oh my gosh. That's
the other thing, Jeff. So you do a show 4 hours. Let's say it went really well.
Yeah.
I'm in my car driving home. I'm not thinking about all the things that went well.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about the one thing that felt awkward or didn't go right.
Yep.
I'm focusing on that, and I'm really focusing on that, and it's digging the hole deeper for me. But that was part of being a perfectionist. I had to learn how not to be that way.
Thanks for sharing that. That helps a lot of people, because when someone like you, who is at the top of their game for 30 years, household name in like the tri-state area, when you talk about it, it makes it safe for other people to talk about it. Like you said, the people at the Barstool, the guy in Northeast Philly, the guy in Kunchy, it makes them like, all right, I could talk about this because Angelo talked about it. Yeah, that's really cool. How about...
Hey, Joe, okay. Before you go on, can I illustrate something for you?
Yeah, right, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I would have... I'll give you an illustration of what you're talking about right now.
Sure.
And as we do this, this is on the Monday, what is it, the 29th, or April 29th,
yep.
The day after the Sixers lost game 4 to the New York Knicks at Wells Fargo Center.
Yep.
After the game, Joel Embiid, he had blamed the fans. And he said that the Knicks fans took over the building, and that's not okay. Mm-hmm. If I were on the air today, this very day, as we talk, I would have ripped him with every fiber in my body. I would have taken all the years of experience that I had and said, how dare you do that when this fan base and this city has been nothing but supportive of you, blindly supportive of you. You haven't gotten past the second round. 4 years of our seasons were sacrificed for the process that brought you here. Mm-hmm. And you did that. You're going to turn on the fans now? And I would have it would have been 4 hours of character assassination. And what I worry about, Jeff, since I was not on to do it, and the first time I'm saying this is to you, is anybody doing it? Mm-hmm. Because he scored 1 point in the fourth quarter of a must win. 1 point. And he didn't blame himself. He blamed the fans. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I learned was the first people you support, people that listen to your show, the fans, just like you, Joe, make sure that you're speaking their agenda. Mm-hmm. And I know, I don't even have to chat. The real fans of Philadelphia sports and of the Philadelphia 76ers were outraged that he would blame them when he scored 1 point in the fourth quarter. And I would have killed him. And you're right. That might have opened up some other lips. Mm-hmm. It's the one thing. And I am not in any way bothering the return. I am never going back. But somebody needs to do that. Somebody needs to do that. And I don't hear it anymore. Mm-hmm. And it really bothers me that the accountability of the fans in Philadelphia is not all that great anymore. They're getting away with a lot more. Wouldn't have gotten away with it with me, not for 1 second.
Yeah. It's almost sometimes people want to be included instead of like getting to the real story. It's almost like, I don't want to say anything, so I want access to them down the road. Like, I want to continue access with them. Yeah.
But that's exactly what it is. I don't want to rock the boat, because here's what else will happen that people may not be aware of. I go on and I say that the coach, Sirianni, I would have said before the last game of the season, Sirianni should have been fired for the collapse the Eagles had in 2023. And the public relations department of the Eagles would call up my bosses, or they would call up us. They would call up someone and say, how dare you? You can't say that. And we would go, look, I can say whatever the hell I want to say. Well, yeah, but you got a business relationship with us. You do our games. We're going to have to sign a contract someday. Good. I'll worry about that when it comes time to sign a contract. That's not my job. My job is to give my honest opinion. And you know what, Joe? It's a lot harder to find an honest opinion now because everybody is intimidated by these teams and the teams take advantage of it. Now, maybe I got a lucky break because I came in before they did that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it's too late with me. Maybe my guess is if I were in my 30s or 40s right now and just starting out, I would not be able to get away with what I said. Mm-hmm. Would say.
Yeah.
I would have still said it until they fired me.
Yeah.
So that's what the fans deserve. They deserve your honest opinion.
Mm-hmm. No, so true. And I think that's what kept you guys in the morning show so relevant for 30 years. I mean, things go out of style in 6 months, like 6 weeks, 6 hours. Like, to stay there for 33 years, that you have to do stuff like that. That's crazy. You mentioned provocative a couple moments ago, the word, you said that a few times. I can't think of anything more provocative in the Philly radio market over 30 years than the evolution of the wing bowl. Right. I remember when it started, it was a little thing. It might have been at Market East or wherever it was. And then it ends up like you can't even get in the building. There's like 10,000 people outside. Like if you had to tell someone what the wing bowl was, how would you describe the wing bowl?
I actually had to do this, Joe, because as we speak here, they're in the latter stages of what is a major documentary on wing bowl. And yeah. I met with the producer at the very beginning, and they said, "Well, why don't you start by explaining what it was?" I went, "Well, no one will believe it. You know, we decided to have a chicken wing eating contest on the Friday before every Super Bowl, and we would bring in people who enjoyed chicken wings and could eat a lot of them, and we would have a contest, and we would give them a prize, and you know, and we would do it really early because our show was from 6 to 10, so." We would start the contest around 8 and it would be over by 9 and people could come as early as 6. And it was in a hotel lobby the first year. Then it was in a bar for a couple of years. Then it was in a nightclub. Then it was in a small concert venue. And then we went at the behest of the mayor then, Ed Rendell, we went to the Spectrum and we went in an arena. And then we went to the bigger arena, the Wells Fargo Center. And you're right. You're referencing the year 2005, when the Eagles were going to the Super Bowl, we had 20,000 people in the building at 5 o'clock. We opened the gates at 5 a.m. And there were at least another 10, 15,000 who couldn't get in. It was the last year we did it with no ticketing. After that, we had app tickets and that, a lot of other safeguards. There's none of it was planned other than what I just described. A bunch of guys getting out to eat chicken wings for contests. It built up on its own. Within a few years, we needed people to count the wings. Why don't we get attractive women dressed provocatively? Why don't we bring in some cultural heroes, Dennis Rodman, Snooki from, what's this, Jersey Shore, so all those things. And we just kept adding to it and adding to it. It went on for 26 years. And right to the end, we got full houses. And it was a phenomenon. I love to say it was the most successful annual radio promotion in the history of the medium, because I know we drew more people. We were giving cars away and trucks, sometimes both in the same year. It was insane. And then it got out of control. It was a lot of young people and they got drunk at these things and there were fights and there was mayhem that we couldn't control. And then finally, when the Eagles won the Super Bowl, we had an excuse to say, okay, we did it. It's over. And we ended it. But it was a heck of a run. And you know, as disgusting as it was in those last few years, I'm still really proud that we held a promotion that was that successful.
That's great. And I remember wasn't Chaz Palminteri there one year? And
he was.
Ric Flair, maybe? Like, I just remember these random.
Chaz Palminteri. He went to Bronx Tale and Chaz Palminteri. Now you got to understand, he's been in all these big mob movies and he's done all these great things. He met all these famous people. And he walks in that morning and he comes up on the stage and he looks at me a second time. He goes, "You got to be bleeping kidding me. These people are here to see this." It was great.
No, they were just some crazy, crazy shows. How about this? Do you remember the moment where you're like, you know what? I got to start thinking about when is my time to hang them up?
Yep. I can give you the exact second. Tom Brady's dropping back to pass.
Yep.
Looking in the end zone. He throws a Hail Mary. The ball hits the ground.
Amen.
Eagles have won the Super Bowl. Joe, I knew one thing. One thing I was sure of. No matter what happened after that, it would never match an impact that moment in the lives of the people in that city. Mm-hmm. And I went, I have now experienced the greatest thing that could ever happen in the time I'm here. At the time, I was 67, 66, whatever it was. And I was going, you know what? It's time. I gotta do this. And then it took like another 4 or 5 years for me to work it out, because I wanted to do what Brookie did when he handed it off to me. I wanted the station to have enough time to find people that would be able to fill in or use the people that I still had with me. And I gave everybody notice, several years really. But then I was going to leave the year before. We had that COVID pandemic that held me in a little longer, because it was a real hard time to bring in somebody new. And then I did one final year. And in that final year, the Phillies went to the World Series and the Eagles went to the Super Bowl.
They both lost. Oh, my gosh.
Perfect, imperfect ending to me, Joe. They both lost. Other than the Phillies in 08 and the Eagles in 17, no one ever won a championship in 33 years I was there.
It was, and the Phillies I could handle. I was heartbroken when they used to beat them, but like the Eagles were up by 10 in the Super Bowl there. And I was so, and I think Mahomes might have had he kind of hurt his knee or something at halftime, or he was kind of
couldn't walk.
And I'm like, we're going to win this. And I'm like, they're not going to beat us by 10 in the second half. Yes, they do.
No, Joe, just how about blitzing? I'm still mad now. Blitz the guy. What are you doing? This guy, Jonathan Gannon, got another job. He's not good at that job, but he got another job. Make it harder for Mahomes.
Yeah.
Do something to keep him. He just let Mahomes sit back there and eat them alive.
That's four so painful.
Drives, touchdown, four drives.
When you think of painful losses, what's your most painful Philly loss
that is
in those 33 years? That one?
That was my end game. You understand? I had already announced, if they win, I'm leaving the day of the parade. Uh-huh. I was going on a float. I even had this plan, Joe, that would go on a float. And then when we got near the Schuylkill River, the float would just go right into the river. And my last words would be, glub, 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 glub.
Perfect.
No, they blew it. I still can't get over that. I'm angry about the Super Bowl they lost in the beginning of 05, at the end of the 04 season. They should have won that one, but they couldn't manage the clock, and they took forever to get down there to score the touchdown that gave them a chance. There were so many, because the Flyers two or three times should have won it and didn't. The great Allen Iverson team that won the first game of the NBA Finals.
01. 01, maybe 04.
It was 01.
01, yeah.
And then he would have been beating Shaq and Kobe.
And Kobe in the prime. Crazy. He had he had some people with, but he didn't have like an all-star with it. He had a couple like decent role players with it. Matumbo.
But he was so great.
He was so good.
So he was, in the 33 years, he was the most compelling sports figure on and off the court, because he did a lot both. He was playing a game you couldn't take your eyes off. He was so great.
Yeah. How about the most, the one loss too, it sticks. I was there when they shut the vet down, the Tampa loss against. That was so bad.
The last.
They closed the vet down, and Kiki Barber, Rondé Barber is running back. And Jared Vicious is still running in my head. Like, when I have a nightmare. Joe Vicious is still running like 2 miles an hour. No one's catching him. Oh, my God. That's so bad.
Right. See, the fact that these still bother you, tell me you're a great Philadelphia sports fan.
It's so horrible.
Do you know there are people, it's long before your time, if you find somebody in their 80s, today they will tell you everything that happened in the collapse of the 1964 Phillies. Yeah. They will tell you that Chico Ruiz stole home plate. They will take you through every game. They will explain to you, this is how many years now, 60? Mm-hmm. And it still haunts them. That's the charm of the Philadelphia sports fan. Mostly we've had to deal with failure, and we've learned to deal with it in a way that I find oddly charming. Mm-hmm. It resonated with me. I loved talking after it. It was therapeutic to come on after a horrible loss and get it out of your system.
Yeah. One more loss, the Joe Carter run with Mitch, right? And I was in college. I was at a frat party. There must have been 300 people. It was the craziest frat party. It was one of those frat parties you still remember. And then when he hit that home run, it was like a funeral, like an absolute funeral in a frat house. Like, it was just so bad.
I worked with Mitch Williams for a couple of years. He's great to work with. Mitch himself would tell you he shouldn't have been in the game. He wasn't throwing the ball well. Roger Mason was. Roger Mason should have started the ninth inning, mm-hmm. but didn't, because Jim Fregosi was a robot, and he was just mm-hmm. going to keep doing things the same way, even mm-hmm. the conditions changed. But you see, the fact that we can call attention to all these things and bring them right up in our minds tells me that we love being Philadelphia sports.
Yeah, and then that button, your book is just like a walk through those 30 years. It touches on so many strings. One story I got to tell you, you mentioned COVID a couple of minutes ago, and this, you told a great story about how your mom took you to a doubleheader and how your relationship at COVID, like, you could you just tie those two together?
Yeah, it was my mom. It's funny. I came from a real traditional, old-style Italian family. My father was the breadwinner, and he went out at night. And my mother did most of the heavy lifting when it came to parenting. And my father never really went to any Little League games when I played in a Little League. My mom would. One day, my mom, I was talking with my friend, and my mom said, you know, I think I'll take you boys to see a doubleheader at Yankee Stadium, because we were Yankee fans. And we took a train 3 hours to get there, went to the two games, came back. She spent that whole day with us. And I think that's the day I became the sports fan that made me want to cover sports and do it all. I think she did that for me many, 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 many years later. She's 98 years old. She's in a nursing home. The COVID virus hits. Everyone in the nursing home gets sick. She's 98. She survives the COVID. She overcomes COVID. But they were so strapped for people then, and no one was allowed to go in. And she fell out of her wheelchair and hurt herself and passed away. And I never got to say goodbye to her. And it was like, I owed everything to her. I told her many times that she was an amazing mom and that I loved her. But I would have loved to do it one last time. And I never did get that opportunity. But so many people out there have stories to tell like that because of COVID, especially with the elderly people, because nursing homes shut down. But it was a real, you know, it's a regrettable moment. But what can you say? All I could do is honor her memory by telling that story and telling everybody what a tremendous job she did as my mom.
First off, thanks for sharing that. And then that story is like a microcosm of, I think, how your show had so much impact. I think a lot of people relied on your show during COVID because sports stopped for a while. And then the show went from sports to almost stories like you just mentioned. It was like there's personal stories and people kind of talking. It was almost like a therapy session where people would come along, tell their story, and everybody would collaborate and share their story, right?
Joe, those went well. When it didn't go well, and it didn't at times, was when somebody would call and say, don't get the vaccine. Mm-hmm. And we got political.
It got political, yeah.
Let me make this clear, all right? We did know how to do sports. We didn't and will never really know how to do politics. Yeah, I would save that for Rush Limbaugh and all the people that followed him. They knew how to do it. We alienated some of the people that were in favor of the president, people that didn't like the president, they didn't like us. And I try to stay on the middle because I didn't have a real strong perspective. But if those were the hardest shows, those 3 months when there wasn't any sports, those were the hardest shows I had to do.
Yeah, because anytime you get politics involved, instantly half the people are going to hate what you say and half the people are going to be for it. And then And just say you're a politician on one side of the spectrum, you could say something so reasonable.
Yeah.
The other side will hate it just because you're not on their side. Like you can't, yeah. Like it's crazy. So, yeah. So
that's what I learned.
Yeah. And it's crazy.
Sports would be the most combative, but it isn't. Politics isn't. I just looked back on it. I went, well, boy, I made a good decision not going into news. I'm glad I went into sports. It's a lot safer.
Yeah. You mentioned you were a Yankees fan and your mom took the doubleheader. Can you remember the moment you became a Philadelphian fan? I remember the Yankees World Series. You kind of still were kind of a Yankees fan. Is there a moment where you...
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt. I remained a fan of the teams. I was always a Sixers fan because I love Wilt Chamberlain. So I was that from the time I was a little kid. I was also a Yankee fan. I didn't really have a strong rooting interest in hockey and in football. I was kind of Giants, but not like I was with the Yankees. And the first time, Joe, I know this for a fact, the first time one of our Philadelphia sports teams, I think it was the Flyers, went on a big winning streak. Mm-hmm. It would have been in the early 90s. And the ratings book came out. And the numbers went up because the teams were doing well. I became a fan of all the Philadelphia teams because it put money in my pocket. It made me successful. And then, over time, talking to these fans every day and knowing how much it meant to them, I mean, either you're going to get on board or you're not. And I got on board. So by the time the Phillies won in 08, and even more so when the Eagles won in 17, I was experiencing it as the strongest fans were experiencing. I was overjoyed. Nothing has ever happened in sports that made me happier than the Eagles winning the Super Bowl.
Yeah. Do you think Hurts, does he win a Super Bowl in his career?
Yes, I do. I love Jalen Hurts.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's here.
Yeah. No, yeah, hopefully, yes. How about Bryce Harper? Does he win a World Series?
Bryce Harper has the mentality. He should also be able to win a championship. He's got a good team this year, and maybe this is the year for him. He's definitely a winner. Embiid is not. Embiid will not. I'll tell you that right now. He's soft. But those other two guys, absolutely, they should win one. I'm a huge Hurts fan. I think Hurts was a victim of bad coaching last year, not bad play.
Understood. You have time for a couple fun wrap-up questions just to wrap this up?
Sure.
First off, how about you mentioned golf and your struggles with golf in the book. If you could do your dream golf foursome, who would be your foursome? You go out with anyone, alive or dead, who would you take out?
Great. Okay. If I'm out to have a really fun day, right?
Yep.
No doubt in my mind, Keith Jones is there.
Jones,
the president of the Flyers.
Yep.
Keith Jones is an amazing guy. I'm doing this off the top of my head.
Yeah.
I'm going to need Jason Kelce there.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
Right? Because Jason Kelce is a fantastic, perfect guy for that. And I got one more. Who am I going to go with? This is harder now. Who am I? You know what? I'm going to go a little older school and go to a guy who was the most intense competitor I ever saw. Let's get Brian Dawkins in there.
Oh, B-Dawk. Oh, B-Dawk, man.
Kelce, Jonesy, and me. That's a fun day.
How about that?
Dawk would attack that golf ball. Absolutely.
Oh, my God. Come out, Weapon X, Kelce, and Jonesy, and you. That would be phenomenal. That's a great foursome. Thanks for sharing that. How about this? You wrote an amazing book. You're an author. You went to the Columbia School of Journalism. What book most influenced your life or changed your mind? If you had to buy everyone in Philly a book, what would you buy them?
Here's the book to me. I've read so many books. I'm a voracious reader. The book that had a sports connection with it that I thought about when I was writing mine, because it was a memoir. Mm-hmm. And it was so compelling and interesting and fun. It was written by a former owner of the Indians and the White Sox, who was the all-time great marketing mind in the history of sports. His name is Bill Veeck, V-E-E-C-K. And the name of the book, it's a classic, is Veeck as in Wreck. And it is beyond great. The thing about it with classic, it's always great, even if you don't know the names anymore. Great stories, great. And the other one I really loved was Ball Four, and about Jim Bouton. And the reason I loved that was because it was bold enough to tell the truth about what was really happening in ball and baseball teams when they weren't on the field. It took you inside the hotel rooms and the locker rooms and all that stuff. And it was the kind of honest book that I aspired to write when I wrote my own.
Wow. That's fantastic. Now, thanks for sharing that. I'm going to put both of them in the show notes. How about this? Angela, we spoke about a lot. We talked about almost winning a Pulitzer Prize, Columbia, you know, your mom, COVID, the Eagles, the Flyers, the Sixers, 33 years of owning the Philly sports radio market. If you could have everyone listening take just one lesson away from everything we discussed, what would that lesson be?
Yeah, it's a lesson I give a lot of time, Joe, when I'm in classrooms and stuff. And they say, you know, what's the key to success? And I'm positive I know what it is, because I lived it. And that is to focus in and find the thing that you love in your life when you're young, and then get somebody to pay you to do it as your career. And when I made the decision very early on to go into sports, the last day I worked, was the last day I was on the news side covering for a newspaper. When I went to sports, it never felt like work. And when it doesn't feel like work, when you're loving what you're doing, you're going to reach your potential. Mm-hmm. So find what you love and get somebody to pay you to do it. That's the best lesson I could give in fulfilling yourself as a career.
Wow.
And the other lesson is one I didn't follow, and that's one I acknowledge in the book. Find a balance in your life. Find a balance. Somehow keep that career strong in your mind, but not overwhelming the more important thing, which is being part of a family and contributing there. And if I had to do that again, I would do it differently.
Wow. Just to recap, you mentioned focus, find something that you love, find someone to pay to do it, and then also find a balance in your life. That is so good. My goodness. Last question, Angelo. I asked this to all the guests. Angelo Cataldi, if you had to get a quote or a saying tattooed on your body, what would that quote or motto say?
You know, I'm not prepared for any of this, Joe. You know, I'm going to steal this from Jim Valvano.
Yep.
Right on my, I don't know, maybe down this way, something like this.
Okay.
Never give up. Never give up. Keep trying. Sometimes, maybe you think the race is a sprint. It's probably a marathon. So don't quit. Because you owe more than that to yourself, and you'll feel better about yourself when you finally get to the finish line.
Never give up. That is great. I'm going to end with the beginning of your book, which was written by Hall of Fame sports writer R. Diddy, Ray Diddinger. Ray writes, Angelo Cataldi started the conversation each day. Angelo set the agenda. Other people may have spread the flames, but Angelo was the one who lit the fire. The guest is Angelo Cataldi. The book is Loud, How a Shy Nerd Came to Philadelphia and Turned Up the Volume in the Most Passionate Sports City in America. Angelo, it is such an honor to have you on. Congrats on 33 amazing years. Thank you for being the soundtrack to all of our mornings for the last three decades. Dude, I appreciate you, and just much respect and gratitude for all you've done. I appreciate you.
Joe, thank you for inviting me. I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, buddy. Pleasure to do it.
Hey, everyone. It's Joe. Thank you so much for listening to my interview with Angelo. Hope you enjoyed it. Before you go, if you could please punch out a 5-star review, that goes such a long way with connecting new listeners to the show. I would really appreciate it. Thanks so much. Talk soon.